Weyland-Yutani's classification authority selects monikers designed to discourage mental associations, but Lucy has embraced them. If she deployed weaponized code at this moment, adversaries would have little trouble tracing the project back to RB-232. Dorian watches the skinny woman, with her cartoonishly large eyes and mouth, her messy pixie cut, and he looks forward to reprimanding her for this blatant oversight. Anticipating Dorian's arrival, Lucy has prepared a show-and-tell with large, attractive readouts and graphs. There are many bullet points. She produced a video with motion graphics depicting the effects of Silver Smile on a computer network. The method is simple. Silver Smile uses whatever comms it can find to infect other machines. Then it lashes together a distributed processing system. The more computers it can infect, the smarter it becomes. Once it feels confident, it intuits the most critical infrastructure and attacks it first. Perhaps a dam turbine. Perhaps a life support system. But we're writing it to be restricted to a single location because, you know. Lucy trails off as "Any questions?" appears on the screen behind her. "Enlighten me," Dorian says, and Lucy squirms under his gaze. She's afraid of losing funding. "It'd be like the apocalypse." She laughs nervously. "It'd just spread until it hit a system smarter than it was." Dorian folds his hands behind his back.
"And at this point in your project, aren't most systems smarter than it is? What's the reason for all the delays?"
"Computer science is the process of solving unsolved problems." She holds her hands close to her chest, pulling on her fingers, as if she's wringing a washcloth. "So, you know, I don't think it's easy to put an exact delivery date on..." He watches her waffle. Her answers are vague and insipid, and project managers have delivered code for centuries now. Even her growing panic is uninteresting. It's like playing a game without an opponent.
"Are you from the same Biltmores as the North Carolina Biltmores?" he asks, interrupting a string of vocalized pauses. "Like, the big estate there?"
She smiles, overly toothy beneath her swollen lips.
"I don't know."
Dorian shrugs. "Okay, just curious." He turns. "Next project." 3. The Kennels. They file through the hallways and away from the common area. The safety lighting here is uncomfortably bright, and the floor and walls have been treated with some sort of polymer coating. They reach a bend in the corridor, and a tremendous vault door sprawls before them, covered over in various biohazard warnings. It takes all of Dorian's composure not to roll his eyes. A genetic weapon is easy to control in space. A virus won't propagate through airless chambers. In the worst-case scenario, everyone on the research facility dies, but the virus is contained. Yet they've locked off Glitter Edifice even from the rest of the skiff. Again, multiple keys and multiple codes come out. Blue assists this time with her own codes and biometrics. A loud klaxon sounds, and a computerized voice fills the intercoms.
"Kennels open. Logged access, Dr. Blue Marsalis."
"Juno keeps an extra special eye on this place," Anne says.
Blazing chartreuse covers the hallways beyond, and where most of the station contains exposed pipes and ductwork, Glitter Edifice has only bare walls, with black text signs to direct them. Dorian cocks his head.
"Wouldn't have been my first choice of color."
"Safety measure," Blue says. "Human optical response is strongest between bright yellow-green and black. Though we also could have used a light cyan."
Everything looks purple after you get out of here, though, Yosip adds. Cone strain on your eyes because your green receptors are overworked. The second statement is enough of an explanation that it rises at the end.
Oh, keep that in mind, Dorian says.
And why do we care about green-black contrast?
Survival, Blue says, ushering them in.
The place feels like a bunker. It reminds Dorian of the subfloors of Weyland Yutani's Tokyo office. Impenetrable concrete vaults of records and archived hard drives stored in suspension fluid. It would be easier to rob a bank than to get into the kennels. Here, the corridors are claustrophobic, not the soaring halls of the rest of the Cold Forge, and the lights are even brighter, giving the whole place the feeling of a bad computer rendering. They pass a wide, tempered glass window with a break mesh on both sides. Dorian leans in for a closer look and sees a dissection table. Along the back wall, he spots specimen jars the size of human torsos and distorted, bony hands floating inside. Tails where their wrist bones should be. Scrotum-like diaphragms at the joining. Inside the room, a young black man in a lab coat looks into a microscope. Dorian stares at the claws in wide-eyed fascination.
This way, Blue calls out.
The party has already moved beyond him. Lucy's eyes are even wider here, her large lips pursed and white. She's genuinely afraid of this place.
Is that some kind of trophy room? Dorian asks her, whispering.
More like hell, she replies.
Don't eat any pomegranate seeds while you're down here.
More of a rare steak man myself.
You'll get along just fine, then, she says.
They round a corner to a tall room, at least the height of the skiff common area, with a power loader against the far wall. A darkened set of glass panels punctuates one of the walls, and at first, Dorian believes they're black, or perhaps smoked glass. He notices loading clamps at the base of each panel, making them look as though they're stacked like blocks. The panels are each 10 feet by 10 feet, large enough to fit a truck or docking vessel. As he steps closer, he realizes that the glass panels are clear, and the other side is pitch black. Blue points to the array of industrial lights high above them. Special lensing. Sheds light on the cell block, but not the cells. Keeps the disturbances to a minimum.
Disturbances?
They like the dark.
She pulls a tablet terminal from the wall and types something into the control keys. Everyone steps away from the windows, backing up to the observation area on the other side of the chamber.
I think you'll be more comfortable over here, Director Suttler.
Why?
The effect can be unsettling.
She shrugs.
Don't touch anything.
He shakes his head and steps closer to the windows.
Show me what you're going to show me.
The tap of a key echoes through the chamber. Then comes the steaming hiss and the rending of metal. Something is screeching. Dorian flinches, but doesn't move away. He watches the lights flicker on behind the windows, one by one, illuminating the cells in stunning green. He steps closer to the cell nearest him as the last light flickers on. The creature before him seems to drip from the ceiling before rising slowly to its feet, hateful lips pulled into a sneer around glassy teeth. Its head is a long, smooth shaft of gray like tumbled granite against the oily black of its body. Chitinous protrusions form a brilliant exoskeleton, rippling with muscular potential. Its tail is an array of ever-shrinking bones, tipped by a wicked barb. It is the intent of every murderer, poured into a mold and painted pitch black. It is a symphony of death,
a masterpiece of hellish design, raw will. Blue was right. The effect is unsettling, and he barely notices the yelp that escapes his lips before utter captivation sets in. Dorian walks along the edge of the cell, and the creature stalks along with him, following his movements without eyes. Its posture is sunken, powerful legs bent like coiled springs. Tendrils of sticky drool ooze from its mouth. His heart rises in his chest, and he wants to weep for the beauty of it. Blue is a genius of the highest order.
"Did you make these?"
he asks, his voice almost a whisper.
"No," Blue says, to his relief.
"I'm not even authorized to know the origin of the eggs."
"What are they called?"
"I have my own names, but nothing I've submitted, since they're highly classified. One of the company sourcing guys called them xenomorphs, but that's kind of a misnomer. Any creature for which we don't know the taxonomy is technically a xenomorph," Blue says. "We've been calling them snatchers, honestly, because they're so goddamned fast."
"And what do we want with them?" Dorian asks, but he's beyond questioning their presence.
"Why research them?" "They have a broad-based general application," Daniel says. "With appropriate control loops, you're talking about quashing insurgencies, destroying structures, bringing down entire countries. They're the most potent biological weapon of our age, and if they could be turned to our advantage... Do you even remember the last time the United States Colonial Marines purchased a complete threat response system?" Dorian rests a hand on the glass, as though to touch the creature's muzzle, and it snaps at him like the arc of an electrical current, leaving a smear of ichor across the glass. A klaxon sounds, and a luminous outline of red appears around the back wall of the featureless cell. The screaming from the other cells stops dead. The creature lashes out again, then scrambles into the corner and cowers, wrapping its tail around its legs. No domesticated creature ever compares to its natural brethren. If this is an example of a creature, a snatcher, that's been raised in captivity, what must a xenomorph be like when encountered in the wild? His mind races, trying to imagine. "They're remarkably capable of adaptation," Blue says, interrupting his musings. "The first time they hit the glass, we open the heat shield and expose them to the star for 5 seconds. This marks the first time one has ever taken a second swipe." 4. Plagiarus Praepotens. Blue had hoped to scare off the auditor with her demonstration. It had certainly worked on the last company clown to tour the Cold Forge. She considers showing him an impregnation, but given his awestruck response to the full-grown snatcher, it's unlikely to have the desired effect. She regards him as he strides from one cell to the next, inspecting the aliens as if they were his troops. They respond to him with interest and curiosity, causing her to feel a strange pang of jealousy. Whenever she and Kambili check on the cages, they find the creatures curled into a ball in a state of near torpor. With his tall, slender limbs and black suit, Suddler and the Snatchers seem to be the perfect pairing.
"Well," she says softly, "we've got a fucking freak on our hands."
"I'd consider showing him a little more respect," Daniel whispers. She chuckles. "Like he does for you, Commander."
Daniel slicks back his short gray hair.
"Sometimes it's nice for an old vet to be appreciated. It's not easy commanding on a station full of nerds."
He regards their visitor and adds,
"Besides, he's your gateway to more funding. Look at him. He loves this shit."
As if feeling their gaze, Suddler turns away from the Snatchers. Since I'm going to be conducting my research on the station, he says, I'll require quarters with the crew.
I told you, Daniel whispers. Squeeze him.
Lou forces herself to smile.
You like the kennels that much, do you?
Sudler's pale blue eyes shine in the lime-tinted light of the cells.
I think it's the future, Dr. Marcellus.
Well then, Daniel says, we'd better get you situated. He gestures toward the door, and Sudler precedes them. Once on the other side, Blue heads towards the vivisection lab. There she finds Kumbili sitting at his workstation, head bobbing, chewing gum, earbuds in. She's glad the auditor didn't ask her about alien reproduction, because that would have led to an awkward conversation about the eggs and chimps, and why most of the aliens were terminated before reaching adulthood. She's been tasked with finding a reliable way to create and control the Snatchers, with an eye toward military deployment. 50% of the way through her funding, and 80% of the way through her chimps and eggs, she hasn't even started that task. It isn't something she relishes explaining. Up to now, conditions have been perfect. The Cold Forge is remote. Elise Kodo, the Vice President of Genetic Interests, has been willing to lie for her, provided Blue could get what she wanted from the alien genome before anyone catches on. Then they'd be able to unveil their discovery to great fanfare.
Was that the auditor?
Kumbili asks, startling her. He's taken out one of the earbuds.
Yeah, she replies.
He smirks.
Did you tell him you're not doing your job?
No. Blue scowls, and judging from the look on Kumbili's face, it's effectively menacing.
Did you tell your wife back home that you've been fucking Lucy?
Listen. No, you listen, Blue says, drawing close to him. Marcus is shorter than Kumbili, but the android body could break him in half, and he knows it.
Stay in your lane, or I will ruin you. Are we clear?
He averts his eyes.
I just want out of this shithole.
I want you out of here, too, but I need your help for now, so I guess we're both pretty screwed.
I'm not going down for you.
Blue's nostrils flare. How can he be so brilliant and so thick at the same time?
I didn't ask you for that. Just work until I'm dead, okay? Then you can pin this all on me. Don't get cold feet just because of Director Sudler out there. Either I'm right and we both get paydays and promotions, or I die. And you can tell everyone how horrible I was. No matter what, you're going home next rotation, so, you know, man up.
She says this last bit in Marcus's lower register, imitating Kumbili's characteristic eye roll. Kumbili juts out his jaw, shaking his head. His muscles are tense, and it looks as if he wants to hit her. But that would be a hand-breakingly stupid idea. Blue crosses her arms, waiting to feel the blow. But it never comes. After a pregnant silence, she uncrosses them again.
Just tell me what other choice I have, Kumbili.
In the last test, he replies, and Blue perks up. After you were, logged out of Marcus. I think I saw it on the thermoptics. Blue inhales slowly, trying to keep her breath from shaking with excitement.
Saw what, Kumbili?
I couldn't let Marcus see, or he might tell someone, so I covered my workstation, but by the time I could look again, the fluid had metabolized with the soft tissues of the host.
What did you see?
He pulls on his stubbly chin.
I think you're right. Plagiarus prepotens is real.
There it is. Her life's work. Or the work for her life. The second animal that none of the company researchers seem to recognize,
a bacterial terror that can rewrite DNA orders of magnitude faster than CRISPR technology. Weyland Yutani thinks the facehuggers are larval snatchers, but they're really hosts for the deadliest pathogen in the universe. And within the genetic code of Prepotens lies an unlimited potential for a cure for her genetic disorder, for everyone's disorders. Blue has given the facehuggers a real name, too. Manumala Noxidria. The evil hand. The jar of night. She clenches her fists.
You should have told me. Told you what? That I saw it, and we were still too slow? That I was right, she bellows,
though Marcus could get a lot louder.
God damn it, Kambili! We should have been setting up the next test immediately. I knew you'd say that.
He wraps up his headphones and tosses them onto the desk.
You keep blowing through the eggs this fast, you're going to get caught. You get fired, then you don't have any medical assistance, and...
She glares at him. He starts, but falters, and takes a moment to compose himself.
I gave 2 years of my family's life to this job. By the time I get back, my kid is going to be 5 years old, and she won't even know me. If I lose the bonus at the end of this, if I lose my job, my family is fucked. So it's not just your ass on the line here. Keep your head screwed on straight.
Kambili is a cheating piece of shit. He hooked up with Lucy almost the day he arrived and hasn't stopped since. Maybe he feels some concern for his wife and daughter, but not enough to keep his dick to himself. Blue sees in him what she always sees in distant, unaccountable men. A willingness to break any rule that inconveniences him. But he's right about the sample speeds. Elise can cover up project progress, but she can't cover for those missing Noxidria egg samples, each of which is classed as individual equipment. The monetary value of the eggs is something like $150,000 apiece, but that's only the cost of acquisition. The company tracks them as though they were bars of gold, because they're irreplaceable. Elise's last transmission rings in Blue's head. Needed results. Can't protect us anymore. Good luck. What changed? Is it the auditor? If Blue accelerates her plan, will they smoke her out?
It's been a week, Kambili says. Maybe we could, go back to Plan A. Try to find Prepotens inside the body of the facehugger. We've got ultrasound and microsurgical...
Blue shakes her head.
You know that won't work.
We melted our extraction tools last time, and we don't have any more spares. Plus, we never found a decent concentration. The pathogen won't concentrate without a live victim. The Noxidria has to be aroused, and the greater the fear, the more of the Prepotens it will pull together for payload injection. She imagines securing one of the chimps over an egg with some mechanism to catch the facehugger's slithering pharynx and milk it when it attacks. It'd frighten the shit out of the chimp, for sure. In their own ecosystem, would the adult snatchers try to help facehuggers propagate the pathogen? Blue imagines them restraining the victim somehow, and wishes she had more information on the behavioral patterns of the creatures. She doesn't even know where they're from. Constructing a milker would take time, and she'd need help from engineering. It would draw Suddler's attention, since both the articulated restraints and the mechanism would be substantial. Some of the machine learning devs would have to help her with a targeting system, too. Marcus could do it if Blue wasn't piloting him. He was fast enough to snatch the pharynx, strong enough to wring out its contents, plastic enough that it couldn't infect him. But he'd be obligated by his programming to tell others at the company what he'd been forced to do. What if she explained her situation to Marcus? He might deem her safety to be in jeopardy and preserve her confidence.
He might also recognize that she's taking dangerous risks and force her into deep freeze for a flight home. Blue wishes she had more training in synth psychology.
Blue,
you still in there? Kambili says, and she blinks.
Yeah.
Sorry. I asked you what you wanted to do. She nods.
Fear, she says. We've got to find a way to stimulate the chimps and capture the pathogen directly from a surface it won't metabolize.
She needs something antibacterial, or maybe plastic.
Oh my God. I'm an idiot.
What?
We put a puncture into the dorsal side of the chimp's esophagus and fuse in a bioplastic lining up to the throat. We can do collection next to the spine. Keep the chimp restrained, but not sedated.
Kambili smiles. Not his usual baleful, sarcastic smirk, but the genuine smile of someone witnessing a breakthrough.
Just like a colostomy bag.
How soon can we set up the next test without breaking cadence?
4 days.
Thaw one of the chimps. Get started on the surgery. Blue returns to her own body to find it reasonably pleasant. Her guts hurt, but that never changes. Her breath rattles a little when she inhales, the sound of all the fluid aspirations she's had over the years. Her esophageal muscles don't work very well. Her back stings a little from the bed sores as she rolls over. The company had agreed to furnish her with a bed that would prevent them, but when she'd first arrived at the station, it wasn't there. It didn't show up in any resupplies since then either, and she complained to her management once every 3 months. Being Marcus tires Blue, not because it takes spectacular activity to pilot him, but because she must eventually return to this room, this body. Sometimes it seems easier not to be able to escape into the android.
Lights.
She calls, pulling off the headset as the vibrant day cycle fills her room. She needs to contact Elise back on Earth, get her to stall somehow. Blue doesn't know what pressures her co-conspirator faces, but she needs another month. She knows she can isolate the raw pathogen and start reverse engineering it from there. When Marcus arrives, he can give her the terminal and some privacy, so she can encrypt a message. Her buzzer rings.
Enter,
she says, and it unlocks. When the door slides open, Dorian Suddler stands on the other side like a knife. Perfect, hardened and sharp. Blue's heart freezes over. No longer is she ambulatory, looming over him in a powerful synth body. She's alone in her hospital bed, feeling small and weak. I just wanted to meet you in person, he says with a smile, stepping over the threshold. He holds in his right hand a pack of cigarettes and a sterling silver matchbox. It's hard for her to make out any details, but judging from his well-groomed appearance, the matchbox is probably some expensive heirloom. Normal people would use a cheap lighter. But not this clown.
You can't smoke anywhere near here, she states.
He puts his cigarettes and matches down on her nightstand, obnoxiously close to her, and smiles.
I wouldn't dare, he says.
Then he gives her a long look. I didn't expect you to be so... Blue waits for him to say frail.
Black. You said you were with Human Resources?
She asks, looking forward to reporting this conversation.
Yes,
but don't be so sensitive. It's Special Resources. Highly classified assets like yourself, so we can skip all the typical nonsense training. You know how it is. The regs don't really follow you out this far from Earth. He narrows his eyes.
Sorry. I simply got the wrong impression from that Aryan doll you walk around in.
Blue's breath comes out in an angry hiss.
Okay. Well, we've met in person, Director Sudler, she says, lacking the force of Marcus's voice. I'm off the clock, so I'll thank you to leave now.
I have trouble with faces, Dorian says, languidly waving a hand next to his eyes, as though there's something physically wrong with them. Hard to interpret emotions from synthetics. Do you ever have that problem?
It doesn't matter if you can't read Marcus's face, Director, Blue says. Weyland Yutani pays for my scientific acumen, not my feelings. Please get out.
All right, he says, raising his hands and starting to back away. I didn't mean to disturb you. Just so you know, I'm at the end of the hall if you need anything.
You're in the observation deck. That's not a bedroom.
Facilities is making a few modifications, he says. I like the view of the sun.
Yeah,
she replies, remembering the view of the boiling fusion through the panoramic black glass windows.
Everyone does. That's why it's a common area.
I won't be on the station long, he says. Like you, I have some unique needs for my quarters, and I need to be able to spread out. Get a bunch of archival records in there.
Your unique needs are nothing like mine, you prick.
In case someone misses the view, though, he adds, I have an open-door policy. Feel free to come in any time and chat or relax. I love company. If you ever need to talk,
I won't.
About what happened with Miss Koto, he says, but trails off at her comment.
I'm sorry. You're right. I'll leave.
She reacted. She knows she did. It's not as easy to control her face when she's outside of Marcus. Blue may as well ask.
I'm sorry. What happened to my boss?
I just got the news myself. They sent it to my ship terminal during the demos. Dorian jams his hands into his suit pockets. Miss Koto has been arrested and placed on administrative leave. They found her accepting payments from an old competitor, in serious breach of contract, and that she'd embezzled from company coffers. Caught with her hand in the till, I'm sad to say.
Blue's lungs become blocks of ice. She covers her panic with a feeble cough.
That's terrible,
she chokes out.
And it is. Elise has a family. Blue imagines what that's like for the kids, watching their mother be led away. Elise won't have her fortune to defend herself. She won't land in a minimum security prison. Her breach of contract and the ensuing civil battle will sap any assets she had. Blue hopes her old boss had a war chest squirreled away for a day like this.
In the extreme, he agrees. What a waste.
Okay. Then thank you for passing it along, Blue says, letting me know.
I need to get some rest, so just
show yourself out.
As you wish.
He turns to go.
And another thing, Director Sudler, she says, trying to keep her voice steady.
He turns back.
I'd appreciate it if you don't ever contact me inside my room.
Sudler hesitates.
What I'd like to know is, why did Koto do it?
She had everything. Power, influence. Hell, this place basically belonged to her.
Didn't she have enough money, without resorting to career-ending thievery?
He leaves without waiting for an answer.
Blue has her suspicions about Elise's motivations. When Blue was a fellow at Johns Hopkins, she was diagnosed with Bechara's syndrome, and the irony of the case brought it to media prominence.
prominent geneticist suffers rare genetic disease. There were 12 others diagnosed in the world, all children of lifelong colonists and spacers. She was the subject of numerous puff pieces about taking charge of her destiny and having access to the greatest medical supplies and mines in the country. In the beginning, she'd believed the bright side of the story, conducting her research in Earthborn labs, finding corporate partners, uncovering the mystery, and seeking to solve it out of public heroism. But then she grew short on sand in her hourglass and tried more and more desperate solutions. She began to self-medicate. She lost her fellowship. Along came Elise Cotto, saying, "I know where you can find your cure." She flung Blue to the stars, to this pit of hell nestled in the heavens. Blue remembers the pain of her first days here, the screech of the first snatcher, the horror at the facehugger, how she'd thought of herself as the heroine of a journey. If she could only reach the end, she'd be well again. But the snatcher became a tool, and the journey a job. They're going to subpoena Elise's records, she realized. They've probably raided her house. How long before they find the secret messages passed to Blue? How careful was Elise? Will they only see pictures, or will they find the pair's shared ciphers? Dorian Suddler is playing some kind of vicious game, she thought. But what? When she looks over to her nightstand, she sees his silvered matchbox standing guard by his cigarettes. She picks it up and inspects it. Rubies inlaid into an engraved constellation, one she doesn't recognize. She doubts it means much to him either, considering that the suits are almost never scientifically minded. Pretty boy probably just thought it was a neat design. Out of spite, she slides it open to look inside. Some fragrant, sweet wooden matches and a torn-off piece of striker paper. She removes his striker and most of his matches, leaving just enough for it to rattle when he picks it up. She tucks them into the underside of her mattress and smiles.
"Good luck finding more fancy matches on a space station, fucker," she says, muttering to herself.
An hour later, Dorian returns, apologizing, asking about his cigarettes. Interlude. Javier. Being an IT guy for an air-gapped skiff isn't the sort of cybersecurity job Javier Paz had hoped it would be. When he'd gone into network security and counterintelligence, he'd expected to be conducting forensic sweeps, locking down nets, and chasing away hackers. The skiff at the Cold Forge sounded like a dream, but there are no hackers that can cross an air gap. And so Javier's job is to flash all the computers after Silver Smile has had its way with them. It wreaks hell on the systems, but usually only gets as far as the power supplies. The virus is programmed to notice anything they care about and fuck it up as much as possible. In a lot of ways, Silver Smile resembles middle management to Javier. As he walks down the line, flash tool in hand, wrecking the data on the ICDDs, Silver Smile has done another thing it was programmed to do. It's found another pathway in the flash tool. Silver Smile latches onto the tool with little difficulty, riding on the bits that confirm the destruction of data, loading itself into the onboard drive image, a pathway that never would have existed without some help. Now, when each drive is imaged, it gets a fresh install of Silver Smile. It's a greedy virus, taking control of everything it can. It will proceed to burn out all of the power supplies overnight. When Javier is done, he locks up the Silver Smile lab and heads for Juno's control console. He needs to put the flash tool back on the charger and connect it so Lucy can update the image to whatever she wants next. The instant Javier connects his flasher to the bus on Juno, the lights in the room go red. A klaxon sounds, and the console monitor flashes.
System breach detected. 5. Rescue puppies. The first time Blue took Marcus for a sprint down the central strut, it was euphoric. Hurtling forward through the kilometer-long hallway felt like flying, and reminded her of her undergrad days of triathlons and cross-country. For the first time since she'd begun to die, she felt alive. Now that sprint can't end fast enough. Blue rockets through the halls as fast as her synthetic legs will carry her, past the empty crew modules, past the docking bay and escape pods, past the open sockets for more labs and servers, toward the open door that leads to the skiff. Daniel waits in the doorway, waving her onward with one hand, a pulse rifle in the other. She enters to find the skiff in chaos. Sirens shriek, lights flash, red warning lights pop up, then disappear for no reason. "Up here!" Anne calls, drawing Blue's attention up to Juno's server cage. Anne leans out over the catwalk that lines the structure and gestures to a quick-access ladder. Blue takes the ladder 2 rungs at a time, throwing herself upward with each pull. When she crests the top, she finds a sizable group of her crewmates shouting at one another, while Lucy and Javier frantically type away at terminals. "What the fuck were you thinking, Javier?" one of the lab techs shouts. It's Nick, from Josep's project, a pushy little asshole from Oxford. "That's how I always charge the tool. It's fucking read-only. You can't write to it without..." Javier protests, his face unnaturally pale. "It's supposed to be read-only when you're..." "Don't bother him right now," Lucy says, her voice uncharacteristically decisive. Blue has never seen her in a crisis and wonders when she grew a backbone. "We fix the situation first." "What's going on?" Blue asks Anne, pulling her aside. All of the digital folks are here in Juno's cage. She doesn't see Kumbili, and that's a good thing. It probably means the kennels are still in good shape.
"Silver Smile crossed the air gap," Anne says,
"and it's contaminated Juno. Before you ask, we managed to lock it out of the general quarantine protocols." "Shit. Did they take Rose Eagle offline? We can't risk the virus getting off the station."
"That was the first thing Josep did. Wreaked havoc on it, though. I don't think it'll be ahead of schedule for much longer."
"Okay." Blue let out a long sigh. "Any other damage?"
"The virus started a fire in its own lab while we were dealing with this. Halon took care of it, and they've still got backups. Right now they're fighting for Josep's Rose Eagle source data. It's all compromised, including the backups. The virus didn't eat them yet, but we can't restore without potentially destroying Juno all over again. Blue, the Glitter Edifice project files, they're..."
"I have my own backups," Blue says quietly, waving off Anne's concern. "They're current to last cycle."
"What? Where?"
Anne's eyes narrow, and Blue regrets opening her mouth. "I've been maintaining a private server in the kennels, just in case something like this happened." Blue glances around, keeping her features neutral. "Looks like I was right." In truth, she didn't want Juno poking around her files. She certainly didn't want the other project managers to have access when she had no intention of filling her Weyland-Yutani project charter. Anne guides her away from the group, out onto the catwalks.
"An unauthorized server? You know I never would have condoned that. How long has this been going on?"
6 months.
"You kept this from me while we were together?"
Anne bares her teeth and ruffles her hair.
"Jesus Christ! Unbelievable!"
"Don't be like that," Blue says, starting to call her babe, but the word dies in her mouth. Anne had been the one to end it. She enjoyed Marcus's body well enough, but she couldn't stand to be with someone so close to the end.
Don't make this about us. Blue corrects herself. I took precautions to keep my project intact, and they're working.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be so sure. Silver Smile has targeted the control systems for the kennels.
Blue shakes her head. It can't open the cells. No computer can. Only a human has access to those controls. Anne laughs bitterly, resting her hands on her hips.
I know that. Not the cell doors. The heat shield. The virus destroys the most expensive and critical systems. It knows how much we value Glitter Edifice. Right now, everyone is busting their asses to save your big bugs. Just be glad Juno doesn't touch the life support systems, or we'd all be dead.
Panic sets its claws into Blue's chest. She imagines every one of her fully grown snatchers burnt to a crisp in seconds, watching them pop like ancient flashbulbs, vaporized in the heat of Kaufman's radiation. If that happens, the company will cut its losses and shutter her project. They'll send her home. She'll never touch the aliens again.
Ladies?
They both turn to see Dick Mackey striding toward them down the catwalk. The Australian's ordinarily tanned skin is sallow, probably from a long night of drinking. When he finally reaches them, a wave of body odor washes in their direction.
I see we're having an eventful morning.
Anne snorts.
Glad you could finally join us, Dick. It's been 10 minutes since I called.
Had to freshen up, he says with a grin.
Given his appearance, it's a complete fabrication. Blue has known Dick to get all kinds of contraband onto the station, from unlicensed firearms to cocaine, and she imagines him doing a line to get his head screwed on straight.
What's wrong? Don't tell me the puppies are loose.
She hates it when he calls them that. When they were testing his kennel's design with one or two specimens, he named one Heath and the other Shrimpy, and moped when Blue had to kill them. In spite of his many eccentricities, he's created a secure work environment.
No,
Blue says, thankful that at least they're not facing a quarantine all kill. But Silver Smile has control of Juno. It's trying to open the heat shield in the cells.
Bloody hell, Dick says, pinching his lower lip. You've got to get out there.
Blue cocks her head.
What? The turtle, the EVA thingy, Dick says. Since the repair pod went belly up, it's all we've got. It's not exactly radiation proof, but your kind won't get cancer. You're the only one who can do it, he says. Well, Marcus is, anyway. I can talk him through it, if you don't want to control him.
Blue looks up to the ceiling. I'm sick of everybody telling me what to do with this body. It's the only one I have.
Is this really the time to be complaining? Anne asks. Your project is about to go up in smoke.
That isn't true. They still have 20 eggs, and if all the adult creatures are dead, Blue might be able to use it as an excuse to replenish her stock of snatchers. That means accelerated testing for her side project. They could be pulling 2 embryos a week or more without raising an eyebrow.
It's not worth the risk, Blue says,
and Anne gives her a shocked look. We still have a small stock of eggs. I don't have a replacement body. You can't do this project without me, and if I can't get around, it's on hold until the resupply. 6. Smoke and Mirrors. When Dorian first hears the klaxons, he expects some kind of minor incident. That's how things on space stations work, 200 warnings for every little thing. Much ado about nothing. His bed is comfortable, his eyes heavy. The light of Kaufman dimly suffuses the observation deck with an evening glow through the electropolarized glass coatings. It's a peaceful place. Minimalist surroundings balanced against the raging inferno outside.
He could watch the glow of fusing gases for hours at a time. But the klaxons won't go away. He hears crew shuffling in the hall, the rapid footsteps receding down the central strut. Muffled shouting echoes into his room. He harbors the tiniest spark of hope that one of the snatchers has escaped, just because he'd like to see what it would do to a crew member. Would it be swift, or relish the violence? Surely the crew would have it all under control by the time he got there. After all, controlling the creatures is the whole purpose of the station. He wishes Blue would open up to him more about the animals. He wants to know everything about them. If she has a dead one, he wants to touch it. Somehow the strange claws in the lab vats must be connected to the screeching, chitinous beasts. His intercom beeps, and Dorian swears.
"Director," says Commander Cardozo, "are you awake?"
"I am now," Dorian replies, the words hoarse. He's been in cold sleep for a year, but the first time he tries to bed down for real, he gets interrupted. If this is some sort of routine drill, he's going to kill someone. Or at least see to it that they're terminated.
"We've got a situation at the skiff. As the station commander, I'm requesting your presence, ASAP."
His heart speeds up. Maybe he was right, and someone is dead. He climbs out of bed and pulls on a pair of trousers over his briefs.
"Do I need to alert my crew?"
he grunts, rummaging through his baggage for a dress shirt.
"No, they should be fine."
"Is everyone okay?"
"Yes,"
he says, and Dorian's heart sinks just a little.
"Though we've got a tricky operation in the works. As the highest-ranking voice of the company, we need your input."
"Okay. Be there in 10. Knowing that it isn't a matter of life and death, Dorian takes a little extra time getting dressed. When he arrives at the skiff, his bedhead is tamed and shirt sharp. He left off the tie since he's supposed to appear informal. Daniel is ready for him at the door, failing to hide his displeasure at Dorian's response time.
"The eggheads are busy inside. They'll bring you up to speed."
"And you're just going to stand here and hold the door?" Daniel shakes his head.
"This is an IT and security problem, but if this door closes right now, it might not reopen without some serious mechanical tinkering. No one inside needs my opinion, and they certainly don't need me getting in the way."
"So you might have to take the door off the hinges?"
"Yes, sir. And if that happens, safety protocols dictate that we destroy all of the biological specimens, so we don't want that."
Dorian imagines all those incredible creatures murdered due to sheer human incompetence.
"No, we don't."
The commander punches something into the terminal next to him. A set of wayfinding lights clicks on in the floor, bright green with a white flashing runner.
"This'll get you to the war room," Daniel explains. "Please head straight there."
Nodding without reply, Dorian follows the line through the bowels of the skiff and into one of the many conference rooms. It's clear from the layout and affordances that the facility was designed for 3 times the number of staff. It could easily have housed 300 people and 50 projects. When he arrives, he finds a shouting match between Anne, Blue, and a third person, a tanned man he doesn't recognize. A long, edge-lit table runs the room, and screens dot every wall. Blue stands in the back corner, arms crossed, staring daggers at her 2 colleagues on the opposite end.
"It's perfectly safe, and if it's not, I can repair you."
The tanned fellow shouts at her, so Australian that his "you" stretches on for 3 syllables.
"Come on, Dag."
"I don't believe we've met," Dorian says, extending his hand to the new person.
"Director Dorian Suttler. I'm here to help, Mr.
Dick Mackey."
"Nice suit,"
he replies.
But as you can see, we're all a little pinned at the moment. So if you could stay out of the way.
What seems to be the problem?
Director, Blue says, we're in an emergency so we don't have time to brief you.
You want to let them die, Anne says, so we've got all the time in the world.
Director, the Silver Smile virus is threatening the cells. We've got people working on flashing Juno, but if we don't lock down the heat shields, it's going to incinerate our cargo. We've got an EVA kit that can be used for repairing the star side of the station, but it takes an android body to survive.
Perfect, Dorian says with a bright smile. Let's get this cleared up.
It's not that simple, Blue says. If something happens to me, to this body, I won't be able to lead the project. Silver Smile has just jeopardized itself and Rose Eagle. Fucking up Marcus will take down Glitter Edifice.
She looks to Dorian.
Director, we can make more specimens to train. Egg storage is completely intact.
Dorian is seized by questions about Snatcher reproduction, but there's no time to ask them.
Yeah, Mackie says. Except you haven't had any more reliable births. The past three eggs have been duds. What if something's happened, and you've got only duds in there?
Blue throws up his... her hands in exasperation.
We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. You've got 63 adult specimens in the cages, Mackie responds, sinking into a chair. You bloody well better cross it now.
Status update, guys, someone says, the voice coming over the intercom speaker.
What is it, Javi?
Anne calls back.
It must be Javier Paz, the sysadmin. The virus has partitioned itself, and it's doubled down on the kennels. It's got one of the shield doors open.
What are you saying? Dorian asks, letting an uncomfortable edge sink into his voice.
We're down one specimen, Paz says. I'm sorry.
I have every confidence in our ability to impregnate, Blue says. As strong as your opinion may be, Dick, I'm the ranking scientist, and...
Go out there and lock down the heat shield, Dorian says.
Now.
Director, you're not listening.
No, I'm not.
Either you will go out there and lock down the shields, or Marcus will. If it's Marcus, you're fired. I hope I make myself clear.
Everyone gapes in stunned silence. Anne's mouth hangs open.
The project won't work without me, Blue says. I'm the only one with...
There are other, smarter people in the galaxy. I'm sure we can find them. Now I expect you to get out there and do your job.
He looks them over, his eyes scouring theirs for any sign of insubordination. No one speaks to him. No one fights back.
Good choice, he says, his glare boring into Blue.
I want him suited up and vacuum-packed in 5 minutes, Anne.
7. Wild Dogs. The turtle fits Marcus's body a little too snugly. It might as well have a sign that says, ultra-skinny people only. Blue pulls the 5-point restraint into place and does a final system check. All green. The turtle isn't much of an EVA suit, just a mirrored shield on the back and plates along all the edge surfaces. A pack stores propellant on her back, the same as the EVA suits of old. Unlike the old spacesuits, however, this one is composed of many of the same highly reflective composites as the Cold Forge itself. So was the defunct repair pod, before Dick Mackie fucked up a docking procedure. Blue will be able to face Kaufman for 2 minutes before her android body begins to suffer melting temperatures. It will take her 10 minutes to reach a catastrophic failure. A normal human would be fried or develop cancer if they were lucky enough to live.
Okay, mate.
Dick's voice is raspy over the radio,
I'm going to close the blast shields inside the kennels now.
In spite of herself, Blue is glad to have him helping. If he